Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dold.
And I'm Patricio Robayo.
And coming up, we've got a lot of news for you from the Times Union. Not just less than an hour ago, Patricio spoke with Philip Pantuso, Times Union. Is that right, Patricio?
Yeah, is this literally hot off the press? Well, it's not really the press. Hot off the digital airwaves. Yeah, there you go.
The digital press. Yeah. So we're going to get into this now, Patricio, but I just wanted to take a moment. We could talk about this again after we hear a bit from Philip, but like this is, I'm both proud of and profoundly grateful for our many news partnerships and our news partners that work so hard with us to bring us the news, and just the benefit that that relationship brings to both entities, whether that's Spotlight PA, New York Focus, Sullivan County Democrat, or on Thursday evenings on the local edition, Times Union, talking to the Hudson Valley Bureau Chief, Philip Pantuso, every week.
Yeah, these partnerships has been so helpful to us and getting the news out to our listeners. And these reporters are doing it on their own time. We're not paying them. They're not paying us to do this information. And they're eager to get their stories out. And it's just been a really great partnership that we have, like, say, with New York Focus, Spotlight PA, Times Union, and now with the Capitol Press Room, Sullivan County Democrat, River Reporters, all these great news outlets are we're all banding together and getting the local news out there.
And it shows the value-added good that your donation
Absolutely.
Does. Yeah. Your donation is, you know, your donation does a lot of good for us right here, but it has these knock-on multiplier effects. Your donation is also helping fund NPR and other news outlets who have reporters around the country, around the world, that we wouldn't be able to fund. Your donation is helping us, helping the staff host these local news shows where we can amplify the voices and the reporting of our local news partners. So you're making an investment in having a healthy informational ecosystem here in our listening area. And there was one other point I wanted to make about that. It's starting to elude me now.
Well, also the New York Public News Network that we're part of.
That's part of it too.
Whole bunch of stations, WAMC, WSKG, WXX. So I'm actually wearing my WAMC socks today.
I know. I'm kind of jealous because I've lost one of them. So I'm constantly seeing one of my red, white. These are from WAMC. They're red, white, and blue socks with the Statue of Liberty on them. So they bring good vibes, especially during the fun drive when we're all standing up for the freedom of speech and sharing good and accurate information. So this is what we do on the local edition. I'm so grateful that we're able to do this. Oh, and that's all I was going to say is I've talked to Philip Pantuso about this both on air and off air, and he said like this partnership helps him too because it's let him know more about what's happening in our area. It helps him coordinate, you know, his Hudson Valley reporters and those that come up into the Catskills a little bit as well. And we've been able to share content that our reporters have done with the Times Union as well.
We have collaborated a couple of times with a couple of articles with the Times Union. Recently with Genevieve Harnett and also myself when the PepsiCo factory was closed down.
So we're going to get into our interview with Philip. We're going to get the latest news, but we will be back to ask for your support. So why not show that support now? As we get into the news, remember, we're waiting to hear from you. Give us a call, 845-482-4141. Support this amazing Democratic media initiative here. Put your money where your ears are. Lend your support. Help us out. 845-482-4141. Donate at wjffradio.org. That's wjffradio.org. Get into the interview with Philip Pantuso.
So basically, tenants there, it's a manufactured home park, have had a lot of complaints over the years about essentially their living conditions. You know, we've done a couple of stories late last year about the mobile home park and about some of their allegations. And they include things like, you know, water that comes out of the tap and out of the shower head is brown and dirty. Sometimes their water's been shut off entirely. There have been leaky water systems, and then other kind of sort of lack of upkeep by the park's owners, including failure to replace hydrants or remove trees or secure abandoned or dilapidated homes. As you kind of noted, some of the residents there have been sounding the alarm about this for many years, and there have been well-documented health and safety issues there. There have been, you know, long-lasting boil water notices, some residents have claimed that drinking the water has made them sick. And so what this ultimately culminated in was a lawsuit from the Attorney General's office, which they filed last October, I believe it was. And the decision to this week, I believe it came in on Wednesday, was in favor of the Attorney General's office, basically saying that they had won their lawsuit against the LLC that runs and owns River Valley Estates over years of mistreating residents and illegal rent increases. The judge in State Supreme Court in Sullivan County found that River Valley and its owners, whose names are George Levin and Gayla Sue Levin, had violated state laws by failing to provide residents with consistent clean water for years and for charging illegal fees and instituting rent hikes that cumulatively cost residents hundreds of thousands of dollars, according to her decision.
Yeah, and let's say it's been an ongoing issue there. Have you have any response yet from the owners? I know because we're working on the similar story, and we have not gotten a response back yet. And even in prior articles, they've never really responded publicly to all these things.
Yeah, we're in the same boat. We have not heard from them either. I'm not sure if we will, because they haven't really spoken to us in the past. You know, we've tried to reach them directly. We've tried to call the mobile home parks office. We've tried to reach their attorney, and they've never gotten back to us. When we've reported them in the past, there was a pending legal case. That case is no longer active, of course, so maybe they will this time, but I'm not exactly holding my breath.
Do you know the next steps about when some of these changes will actually happen on the ground, or is enforcement of this all still a sort of a challenge, if you know?
So the court is going to consider soon, according to the Attorney General's office, additional remedies, basically. So Attorney General James is seeking more than $2 million in restitution for residents, in addition to some $200,000 in civil penalties for the aforementioned violations of the law. So it kind of remains to be seen exactly what penalties will be leveled. So that's going to be the next step.
Right. So we definitely keep our eye on that. It's just, especially this is hyperlocal. This is right in our neighborhood in Lost Sheldrake in Fallsburg. It has been such an ongoing issue there. And I've been to plenty of meetings with the residents there. And it's just been heartbreaking to hear some of the stories they hear, especially I'm sure you've seen the bottles of water that they say come out of the faucets, which are sometimes colored yellow and brown. It was definitely something to be seen. So.
Yeah, not you know, our articles have some photos of the water, and it's doesn't look like any water I would drink. I'll put it that way.
Definitely. So, and that article is up in. Is it up in now in Times? On the Times Union now will be tomorrow or.
Yeah, we'll have our article about the court decision tomorrow. A little bit more reporting we want to do, and hopefully hear back from the owners of the park, or at least their attorney. But you can read our previous reporting on the lawsuit. And the issues are one of our reporters, Landa Bellamy, spent a couple of days visiting and with the folks out there and getting a tour of some of the conditions. So there's a lot of photos and a lot of on the ground reporting from that scene.
Thank you so much for that reporting. We came into, we'll look forward to seeing the article and the additional reporting that folks do at Times Union. So we're in the midst of election season. Election day is only a few days away. Now the courts have uploaded that there will be an election year shift. That the law moved local elections to even-numbered years, right?
Yeah, so this was actually a law that passed the state legislature that would move a number of local elections to even years in counties where they're in odd years. Somewhat frustratingly, if, let's say, you're an editor who oversees a large coverage area where counties hold elections differently, some counties in the state of New York hold their elections on or during odd years, which voting advocates and a lot of elected officials say kind of suppresses turnout, because obviously there's much more turnout during even year elections. You know, of course, every 4 years there's a presidential election that usually generates the most turnout, but then every 2 years, you know, we have the midterm elections, at least in between the presidential elections, and there's higher turnout for those as well. But, you know, there are a number of races that, you know, will be decided in next month in what's an odd year election. And some of those, you know, in some of the counties in the Hudson Valley and the Catskills, those are just things like city council races and stuff. But in some, like such as Orange County is electing a new executive, a new district attorney, and, you know, a lot of other counties in the state have those elections in even years. And so basically, state lawmakers in Albany got together and were like, let's shift this once and for all and make these offices even year elections. And this only applies to offices that are set in the state constitution. So that includes elections for district attorney, county clerk, county sheriff, town justice, and the judges in family court, county court, and surrogate court. So that law was passed, and it was immediately challenged by a number of counties that currently hold odd number elections, essentially on the basis that it was like unconstitutional to shift for state law to shift what's happening, like when counties hold their elections. And the State Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in New York, ruled unanimously today that the law was in fact constitutional. So what that's going to mean is that the offices, it's not going to affect any of the elections that are happening next month, but it will affect many of the offices that are being elected next month. So for example, the Orange County DA, who is elected next month, rather than serve his typical term, his term is going to be a year shorter because that next election will be in an even year. And that's going to happen across the state. So there is one potential next step here, which is that the counties who filed the lawsuit to try to overturn the state law, they could move this to federal court, either by seeking an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which may or may not choose to hear it, or by filing a federal lawsuit and just starting the whole legal process over again. It's unclear if that's going to happen or not, but as it stands, you know, all the counties are going to be on the same page in the state of New York in moving their elections to even year.
Yeah. So I guess the what I'm understand is the reasoning behind the original proposal for this law is to, like I said, when big election comes, like the even years, like the presidential, there's more of a greater turnout. But I wonder whether those small elections may be overshadowed by the larger elections. Do you see that happening?
I mean, that's definitely a counter argument that supporters of odd year elections and opponents of this law have made. Their primary argument was that the state law conflicts with sections of the state constitution that delegate power to localities to craft their own governmental processes. New York State's constitution, quite famously, gives municipalities quite a lot of power in setting their government and setting their rules. But yeah, certainly another point that advocates have made was that amid all of the attention to races at the top of the ballot, be those congressional races or every 4 years presidential races, that may drown out sort of attention and bandwidth for some of the local races. And that when you hold those on odd years, that maybe those races are able to get more attention. Certainly, it's indisputable that the turnout is lower, though. You know, turnout in these odd year elections is well below what happens or the turnout for even year elections. And so while undoubtedly there are people who may not get to the bottom of the ballot or may not turn their ballot over and get to all of those local elections in an even year, just the sheer increase in the amount of people who are going to the polls at all means that very, very, very likely more people overall will be voting in these local elections in even years than they were in odd years.
You are listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Support comes from Country House Realty, a boutique brokerage specializing in the best of Sullivan County. Country House Realty, offering exceptional spaces in beautiful places. More at countryhouserealty.com. And from listeners like you.
We have campaigned on a very specific set of commitments. I would argue that far more than many other campaigns, New Yorkers know exactly what it is that I'm running on. I'll have people stop me in the street and just shout, fast and free buses, or universal childcare, or freeze the rent.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
That's coming up in just about 13 minutes right here on Radio Catskill. We do have the rest of the local edition to get to. This is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Patricio Robayo is here with me. Patricio's been talking to Philip Pantuso here on today's show.
Yeah, we talk to Philip every Thursday. It's a partnership that we really hold dear, getting news out there for the Hudson Valley and the Sullivan Catskills. And our next story that we talked about to him about today has to do with immigration, had to do with an Afghan family. And also the conditions at the Orange County facility, correctional facility, that is currently housing some potential ICE deportees. I guess that's what you say.
Yeah,
folks who've been captured, who've been rounded up, I guess, by ICE are being held there in Orange County. And a report recently came out that some of the facilities there are substandard.
Well, and we're going to get into that report right now, but as we do, we need to hear from you, so please call and donate. This is our fall fund drive, and we need your help. Call 845-482-4141. Go to wjffradio.org. It's wjffradio.org. Let's go to those stories now from Philip Pantuso, Times Union.
So let's move on to some immigration news. About an African refugee was detained after an asylum here. Can you tell us what happened in this case, and why is it drawing so much concern, especially from immigrant advocates?
Yeah, so this was the story that we broke last night, about 6 p.m. or so. Maria Silva, who reports on immigration for us, she reported that 31-year-old Afghan man named Ali Fakhrizada, he and his family had resettled in Ulster County in 2022 after the fall of Kabul and the Taliban came back into power in Afghanistan. He was at a preliminary screening for an asylum hearing, doing an interview that's called a credible fear interview, which essentially is when an asylum officer asks you a few questions to determine if you have a credible fear of persecution or torture if you were to be deported back to your home country. If they say yes, then you go on to the next step in the asylum process, which is a hearing before an immigration judge. Right. He was in Long Island, completed his hearing, got a court date for November, and as he was leaving, he was arrested by ICE agents. And we first heard about this kind of through the grapevine of sources that we have here. Confirmed it with his sister and with the reverend of a church in Ulster County that works with the handful of Afghan families that were resettled in this area in 2022. As people might remember, of course, the U.S. government resettled quite a number of Afghan families across the U.S. and a few dozen or so here in upstate New York, mostly in places like Albany, but a handful in the Hudson Valley as well. And their priority with resettling these families was people who either had helped the effort in the war on terror over there, either serving as translators or drivers or other ways assisting the U.S. military, or people who faced, you know, a severe threat from the Taliban. And that was the case with this family. So I mentioned the sister of this man. She had been the director of a non-governmental organization in Afghanistan called the Women's Business Resource Center. This was an organization that was funded by the U.S. government to promote female entrepreneurship in Afghanistan. Her role basically was to help women there who basically, you know, just didn't have opportunities under the Taliban, develop business opportunities for themselves. Of course, that went away when the Taliban came back into power and kind of immediately broke some of the promises they had made about, you know, about the restrictions that they would or would not place on women in Afghan society. And so she fled, and her family left a couple months later, and they reunited. Or first they were in California, and then they ended up moving to Ulster County when they heard about a couple of other families that had been settled here and about this church and this network of volunteers in New Paltz that had worked to make these families feel at home. And they all began going through the asylum process. Ali, the man who was arrested, has been working as a security guard at the Kingston Hospital, and he's a full-time student at Bard College as well. So, yeah, I mean, the reason we ended up reporting on this and why we felt it was a big story was because, and to answer your other question, why advocates are so up in arms about it is because it's another example of federal immigration agents kind of extending the crackdown to places we just really haven't seen it in this country in a very long time. This was a family who was living and resettled in this country for years now, who had been, we'd gone through the approved legal process that the federal government and the Biden administration had laid out for them. The man who was arrested was attending an asylum hearing where literally the last thing that happened to him was an asylum officer said, yeah, you actually do have a credible fear of being persecuted or being tortured if we were to send you back to Afghanistan. Now, it's worth noting that according to USCIS guidance, federal agents are allowed to detain people while they're going through this credible fear process. But the fact that it was ICE agents that took him is unusual.
Yeah.
And really the fact that it happens at all is unusual. I mean, I think typically if anybody is detained while they're going through the credible fear process, it's at the border. It's a story we reported last night. We haven't heard from ICE yet about why they did this essentially, but he already is in their online detainee locator, so confirmation from them that they did in fact take him.
I don't know if I missed it, but what's next for the family?
It's sort of to be determined. Like, they in this situation, there's not a lot that they can do other than try to seek media attention, because it does seem like in some cases that has been effective at curtailing what many people might feel is an overreach by immigration authorities when it comes to deportation proceedings. So this family, they were actually profiled in The Guardian last year as part of a story that The Guardian did about this network of volunteers and the church who were helping resettle Afghan immigrants in Ulster County. So they have, they're trying to drum up some press. That's partly how we ended up hearing about it as well. Today, anyway, as of when we're speaking, we don't have a lot of new information about what the next steps are for Ali, the man who was taking him. But attorneys at a human rights legal nonprofit in New York City have filed a habeas corpus petition to request his release. So probably the exact next step will be there will be an emergency ruling on that, and then in DHS's response to that petition, we may get a little bit more clarity about what their rationale is for arresting him and what their plans are for him, whether it's just they're going to hold him until his hearing or whether they plan to deport him.
Well, let's keep on this immigration topic here. Your Times Union is reporting that a report found systemic deficiencies in medical care for detainees of staying at the Orange County, or should they held at the Orange County Correctional Facility. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so this was a report that came out, I believe last week, by a civil rights nonprofit group called the New York Lawyers for the Public Interest. And they were looking into allegations of health misconduct, basically, and what they termed, quote, systemic medical failures at the ICE Detention Center in Goshen at the Orange County Jail. So what they found was, well, what they did is that they obtained the medical data of 19 detainees there between January 2022 and May 2024, which I should note is a really small fraction of the number of detainees. I don't know exactly how many people were detained there over that specific period of time, but just this year, and of course, the arrests are way up this year, but just this year, there have been 353 people in ICE detention at that jail through July. We're talking 19 detainees over 2.5 years, when there probably would have been several hundred at least detainees through there. Nevertheless, they looked at this, they looked at these medical data and found that all 19 individuals had what they called critical gaps in medical care, while they were detained by ICE at the jail. This included delays and denial of treatment, poor nutrition, inadequate treatment for acute pain, and failure to evaluate and manage chronic illnesses. And this is, well, I should say, first of all, like the county, Orange County, which has a contract with this jail and with ICE to house people there, disputed the findings of the report, basically for the reasons that I said, saying it's just a small sample, and sort of criticizing it as being ideologically driven somehow. But there's a long and documented history of poor health care at this specific facility. And I won't get all the way into it here. I'll just point people to the article. But basically, the way it works is that Orange County contracts with a private healthcare provider called WellPath, which provides medical services and other healthcare services at Orange County Jail. Orange County Jail has like a criminal wing, and then they have this immigration holding facility as well. WellPath does all of the care there. And WellPath, there's been a lot of reporting over the years in the Times Union, in places like The Atlantic and The New Yorker, into Path specifically. It's one of these companies that provides services on a contractual basis at jails across the country. And there have been quite a number of documented instances of them failing to provide adequate care. And they actually faced a lawsuit related to a failure of adequate care that led to a death, allegedly, at Orange County Jail, which is currently pending. So the county actually ended their contract with them after WellPath went bankrupt at the end of last year. So there's now a new healthcare provider there, hopefully providing better care. But you know, what was surfaced in this report that came out last week that looked specifically at ICE detainees is really hand in glove with what a lot of other reporting has found about the standard of healthcare at that facility of criminal detainees and ICE detainees, and similarly of other detainees who were receiving their healthcare via WellPath across the country.
What does this tell us about detention oversight and its sort of accountability in our region? Because, you know, especially switching back to like the Wildcat strike that happened recently with the prison strikes, we have spoken to those incarcerated in like the Woodburn facility, and they said the conditions there were just deteriorating with the CEO's office, and now with the National Guard in place, things have gotten better for them. But I guess what do you think this speaks to as for the broader issue of conditions in our prison system?
What it shows you really is that there needs to be more oversight, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. You know, and that's actually something the author of the report told our reporter when we interviewed her about this research. You know, she said it would be great to get a little bit more oversight into what's going on and what the county is expending their money and resources on. She kind of framed this as an attempt basically to shine a light on some systemic issues and hope that it, at minimum, starts a conversation about how those issues might be addressed. More ideally, would spur the county to begin addressing them.
Right. Well, of course, we'll be following Times Union on this these stories for immigration. Times Union does a great job of immigration stories that are happening in our area. So we're talking to Philip Pantuso, managing editor for the Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau. Again, thank you so much for these stories. And as always, we appreciate this partnership.
You got it. Take care.
Big thanks to Patricio Rubio, and thanks as always to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union. This has been the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. I will be back here. Well, I'll be back here in just a moment because it's our fun drive as well as us presenting the news in our regular programs. We got the Daily coming up in just a few minutes, but joining me in the studio right now, I've got Patricio Rubio. Thank you for doing that work, Patricio.
No problem. It's always interesting to talk to Philip and all the great news that the Times Union does in the Hudson Valley Bureau.
Absolutely. And also, Andy's here with us. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm good, Jason. How are you?
Good, good, good. So you're about to DJ here in just less than a half hour.
That is true.
Filling in for Claire on Ramble Tamble. You're going to be spinning live from our big studio here next
door. That's true,
from
the main studio. Yeah.
Main studio in Liberty. So you're getting ready for that. And we are going to continue raising funds here. As we get into the Daily, I do want to let the listener know, and I'll let you know, Andy, that during Ramble Tamble. We have a challenge of $250. This is from Lee Hartwell Antiques in Calicoon.
Fantastic.
So if we raise $250 between now and, well, I'd like to do it by 8 o'clock, but we've got this challenge during Ramble Tamble.
Right.
So be the first person. You can help us get started early before we even get into the daily by making your donation now.
It's easy to do. Call 845-482-4141. That's the direct line right into the station here. One of us will answer the phone. We'll take your donation. And you can also skip past all the personal human elements and just go right to wjffradio.org. Just click your way to a donation. It's super easy. You could even become a sound supporter on the website and sign up to have a monthly donation taken out of your account effortlessly each and every month.
Patricio, how are your ears?
Doing good.
It's good because we got to keep one ear out for the phone.
I have my ear. That's why I have my earphone. Yeah,
literally have one ear out, and I'd rather have my left ear out, but that's my bad ear. So I got my good ear out right now to hear if the phone rings. Excellent. We're going to the daily in just 30 seconds here, but again, this is our fall fun drive. We've seen tremendous support from so many listeners. Listener, we just need to hear from you next. Be the next person. Help us out. Be the first person towards this challenge. $250 from Lee Hartwell Antiques. If we raise $250 here this evening, give what you can and do give now. Go to WJFFradio.org. It's WJFFradio.org. Call us here at 845-482-4141. That's 845-482-4141. Andy's coming up on Ramble Tamble. Before that, we've got the Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's the beauty of Italian-American food. From Pacific Northwest pasta to chicken and peppers to all the dishes that end in the word Parmesan, it's a spaghetti party with chefs Joshua McFadden and Christian Petroni. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.